Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Hey, everyone. Before we start today's show, unfortunately, I wanted to share the news that we lost a beloved member of the NBA community over the weekend. Jonathan Sharks, a staff writer at The Ringer, passed away Saturday night at the age of 35. He's survived by his wife, Melissa, and his son, Jackson. Jonathan will be deeply, deeply missed. He was an absolutely beloved member of the media for so many reasons. He's written beautifully about the fight that he's undertaken the last couple years. We ask that if you're in a position to help, you please do so. We'll put a link to the GoFundMe for the Sharks family in the description of this episode. You can also find a link to his GoFundMe on The Ringer's website if you go to theringer.com/authors/Jonathan-Sharks. That's Jonathan, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N. Sharks is T-J-A-R-K-S. If you go to theringer.com/authors, Jonathan-Sharks, you can find a link to his GoFundMe there as well. All the proceeds will benefit John's wife and son. Jonathan will be deeply, deeply missed. Our hearts go out to him, his family, his colleagues, his friends. We ask that if you're in a position to help, you please do so. Thank you very much. Welcome back to another episode of Open Floor, filling in for your host, Michael the Podbina. I'm Rohan Nadkarni, joined today by a very special guest. He's both a former and current Sports Illustrated senior writer. I could have asked him for a title before that, but that felt like too much work for me to do. He's a professor, just truly one of my all-time favorite colleagues, one of the, I think, best basketball writers of all time, Chris Ballard, making his Open Floor debut. Chris, how's it going?
Oh, it's exciting to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. See, already too formal. You don't need to pretend that you're excited. You know, just be you. That's it. That's all we're asking. Chris, I think it's still our most recent Sports Illustrated cover. A story that swept the nation. I think it's fair to say, Chosen Sons, his cover story on LeBron James. And his dreams to play in the NBA with his sons, Bryce and Bronny. We're going to dive deep into that today, get some behind-the-scenes stuff from Chris. Also want to talk to him about some of his past stories. Obviously, we're at still a little bit of a slow point in the NBA offseason here, so that'll be fun to talk to Chris about some of the great stories he's written throughout the course of his career. Before we get into that, we still aim to do a big mailbag episode soon, so keep your emails coming, openfloormail@gmail.com. Chris, I don't know where we even want to begin with this. This story was huge. I was like, you know, every basketball podcast I listened to, every basketball video I saw, they were talking about this story. I'm sure that had to be pretty exciting for you. Can you tell me when you first, you know, when did you first get the idea, I'm going to pitch LeBron and his people on doing this story on him and his sons?
I'd say roughly February or so. after he made the comments about playing with Bronny in the NBA, you know, I've got teenage kids myself, and so I think it's sort of natural as you get older as a writer to write about the things that seem closest to you. So the second LeBron cover story I did was all about his physique and how he was becoming so exceptional as a player. Because mm-hmm. at the time I was still playing in like over 30 leagues, and I was mostly interested in like, you know, how the hell is this guy so good? And now, you know, as you know, my later 40s, and I got teenage girls myself, and I was like, damn, that's a lot to put out there on Bronny. That was my first reaction. It's like, whoa, it's great that LeBron wants to do that, but does Bronny want to do that? So I had that initial reaction to it, and then I did the math and saw that it had been 20 years since the first Chosen One cover, mm-hmm. with LeBron obviously holding the ball. That you know, Grant Wall were a great story for SI, and I wondered if maybe they were ready, because Bronny was the same age that LeBron was, 17, mm-hmm. to put him out there a little bit. You know, Bronny had been very much protected by his parents, understandably so. But now he was 17. He was going into senior year of high school. You know, perhaps they would be interested in putting him on the cover. And so in reaching out, I thought the response would be telling itself. You know, we proposed the idea of a cover shot. Mm-hmm. And it could be LeBron and Bronny. It could be Bronny mimicking the pose. But we wanted to get his opinion on that, because I thought that might be revealing of how LeBron saw this. And so in the back and forth on it, you know, once we got interest, which surprised me a little bit at first, because LeBron hasn't done a ton of media, especially this kind of stuff, in a while. You know, he's got his own media company. He doesn't need to. That's when he came up with the idea of he wanted Bryce to be part of it as well, which we didn't expect. I thought that was interesting.
That's very interesting. Now, you brought up that you'd done a LeBron story before on his physique. I wanted to get to that later, but since you brought it up, I'm going to get to this right now. You tried to make LeBron weigh himself. Is that correct? Like, you showed up to an interview with LeBron with a scale?
Yes. You know, it's funny. I learned this trick from an old Esquire writer, Scott Robb, and mm-hmm. I saw him doing a profile on Shaq, and he had brought essentially props, and it was a way to immediately separate himself in an interview situation. I think he had found some like really old trading card of Shaq, and he brought it to Shaq and showed it to him. I remember watching this play out, and I was like, wow, you know, that's impressive, because he immediately, you know, Shaq didn't know him, but he immediately got Shaq to relate to this item instead of him. And so LeBron at the time, he had been creating all this mystique around how much he actually weighed. Mm-hmm. It was amazingly, it was like, you know, it was like Barack Obama in the beige suit or whatever it was. It was one of these things where suddenly everyone was talking about how much does Shaq weigh? Is he 260? Is he 270? And then he wouldn't confirm or deny anything, which of course fed into the mystique. And I thought it'd be potentially a good reporting tool maybe to actually get on. I didn't really expect him to get on it. But I called ahead to the hotel, the St. Regis in San Francisco, and I made sure they had a scale. And then I brought a backup one in my bag and case. And I showed up, and Gary Walter Yost sets up the portrait room in this ballroom. And LeBron rolls in with his, you know, like 12 other people. And I start the interview, and then I did like the reveal. I pulled it out of my bag. And I was
God.
Just get on it. Just get on it right now. And he thought that was amusing, but he did not get on the scale.
So tell me, I want you to let's unpack that interaction a little bit more. So you were like, I'm going to set him up with a few questions and then bring out the scale. That was your game plan. Tell me what your game plan was there.
Yeah, it was very sophisticated. I have found over the years that if you're spending, you know, 3 or 4 days shadowing someone, you get so much insight into them and you can hopefully create a rapport. But with these interviews, like I think it might've been 20 minutes, 25 minutes. Mm-hmm. It would be the same kind of thing I would get in doing Kobe stories. If you have that limited amount of time, you had to do something to get away from the pat answers right away. Something mm-hmm. to sort of jolt the the athlete into realizing, okay, this isn't the normal interview. That's a hope, at least. It doesn't always work. And that's part of what I was trying to do there, was sort of change. You know, LeBron's coming in and he knows me a little because we've been in the story together, but not really. And something that would sort of change the tenor of the interview.
Now, did everyone else in the room look at you like you were crazy? Was it just you and LeBron in the room at that point? I mean, you mentioned they were setting up the photograph. How did everyone else react to it?
I think I thought it was amusing, right? You know, because it was, part of it was clear he was at that point where he was, he's done such a good job of this since then. And Kobe obviously, this was his expertise. You know, start making your own myth early, you know, create that mythology. And this was another small piece of that for LeBron, right? Maybe I'm 285, who knows? You know, and he wanted to foment that. And so for me, the fact that he wouldn't get on the scale was better than if he had. I mean, like, it would have been like a tiny news item. LeBron actually weighs 272. And that would have, you know, you would have answered the question. But the fact that he didn't want this, he wanted us to wonder, was he superhuman? You know, that kind of thing. I found that to be more revealing.
That was a very, I remember reading that. That was a very fun, a classic Ballardism. So if we could jump back to this current story with LeBron. What I'm really curious is from your perspective, because I think the rumor's been out there for a little while, right? He wants to play with the Sun. And that story he had with The Athletic earlier this year was maybe the first time he went on record with it to an extent. And then obviously, you know, he really kind of, you know, in this story, he says, I like to live in the moment. I'm a visionary. I don't plan stuff out. I'm not sure how much I believe that. What I want to know from you is, obviously, you were there. You were talking to him. Did you feel like, we've both done stories where I think you can sense that, obviously, we're always trying to get to the truth. At the same time, I think if we're being honest, there's always, not always, but oftentimes an agenda someone is trying to push, right? Like when I interviewed Chris Paul in Oklahoma City, for example, it was after his breakup with the Houston Rockets. And there's definitely a certain, I think, perception that he's trying to create in that situation. Did you get a sense from LeBron? Like, did you feel like this was him being really reflective, really honest? Or did you get a sense that there was a little bit of like, is he trying to maybe send messages to some people with this story?
I think he's always intentional. There's one thing that if you spend any time around him, and especially at this point in his life, very intentional. And to a remarkable degree, where if you're doing an interview with LeBron, he's like entirely focused on you for however long it is. This is 30 minutes. I mean, it's really impressive. But then if he's coaching his son's basketball game, which is what he was doing that weekend, you'd watch. And he's not like getting distracted, checking his phone. Okay, no, it's like 100% locked in. Like he has that ability, or maybe he always did. Maybe he sort of worked on this. He will be in that moment, very present. And so I assumed there was a grand plan to this. I assumed this was going to play out in one to the next. You know, he would plant this comment and that would start things churning in the minds of the Lakers and other teams, the NBA, while at the same time, you know, it's a message to colleges about Bronny, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's a little bit of that, but realistically what surprised me was that Savannah and Bronny were both taken off guard by this. Like they didn't expect him to say it. And so by the end of the weekend, one of the things that I mean, I could be wrong, but my sense of it was when it comes to his boys, he told me this, he's like, I just get so emotional. Like I can't contain it. I think, and if you're a parent, you totally know this, like you watch your kid score a goal when they're seven and you're having this totally irrational interior response to it. Right. I remember talking to Daryl Morey once, and when he was watching his kids grow up playing soccer, he eventually had to go watch. He had to go to the parking lot and sit in the car to watch the game. Everyone around him was like, Daryl, you're not a positive influence here on the sidelines. He removed himself. and watch, because like it's one of these weird things, you know it's irrational. And so I think that's probably part of what's going on here, is he is just so excited. That's why he was jumping on the court and dunking with them when he was when they were younger. And so in this case, I think it's a pretty pure motive where he's just a dad who really wants to play with his son. And that's why, part of me was wondering, have you thought it through from Bronny's perspective, right? It's like, clearly you're thinking it through from LeBron's perspective, but what about Bronny or Bryce or the other actors here?
You mentioned that, you said it, particularly at this point in his career, LeBron's intentional. Like, I agree. I mean, he says in his story, this is why I created an Uninterrupted. He says, I want to have a little bit more control over the narratives that are out there about me. If we're pulling back the curtain a bit, LeBron has done a lot of SI covers. He doesn't do as many anymore. In fact, I'm a little mad that you did this one and not me. But we've been fortunate. I think he's had a good relationship with our magazine over the years, and there have been some writers, Lee Jenkins is an obvious one, who have had insights from him. You as well. You've interviewed him multiple times. Do you notice a shift in him from now and previous times you've interviewed him? Is there, obviously everyone is going to be different if you give them 10, 12 years, etc. But just in his approach, or maybe what he's trying to accomplish, have you noticed a difference in him just from the stories you've done?
Yeah, I mean, like, the gaps in my stories, I think it was 2006 when he was 21 was the first cover story with him, and then 2009. And then I've seen him for other stories, but not like a big LeBron thing. Mm-hmm. And then, like a decade plus passes until now. Yeah. So, Lee did a number of, exceptional stories, all through the 2010s, but
They were fine.
that guy's got no talent at all. He doesn't work hard. I would say what was interesting is seeing him at 21 and then now, with that span of time, a moment, which sticks out from that first interview was he had, the dozen plus handlers for that one. Mm-hmm. And it was in Cleveland, and we're set up in sort of one of those common room basketball rooms. It's a pretty large room. And all the handlers are there during the interview, which is always a little bit awkward. Mm-hmm. Stylists and PR people and et cetera, et cetera. And Michael Lebrecht, who's one of our photographers, very good photographer, was doing the portrait photos for this. And so he's taking shots of LeBron in various poses, but he wants to get in super tight on LeBron. So as LeBron's talking to me, Lebrecht actually walks up and he's sort of looming over him. LeBron's in a chair. Mm-hmm. And he's getting super tight on his face with his camera. This is 21-year-old LeBron. And LeBron, sort of starts to pose. And then, he just totally lets one rip. And he just starts cracking up. And all everyone else is cracking up. And Lebrecht is a true professional. And he just sticks there taking the photo. That's like 21-year-old LeBron. Like any 21-year-old, right? Mm-hmm. Now seeing him in this setting where he's there with a son on each side, and he's in almost Papa Bear mode in the interview I did this summer, and he's very much modeling for his sons. This is how you do an interview. This is how you answer questions. He's serious. He has matured in so many different ways. That's part of what sticks out to me. He's always, if you go back and read Jack McCallum wrote a really good story about LeBron when he first came to the league, even back then, he was very confident, very intentional, had sort of a larger plan. But I think it's really it's outside of basketball that he's become more of a whole person. Mm-hmm.
The LeBron stuff is interesting to me because obviously he's had this roller coaster in terms of the public perception where he was, we put him on the cover when he was 17. He's a phenom in his early Cleveland years. I think everyone's excited. Then towards the end of the Cleveland tenure, it's like, how come this guy hasn't won anything yet? In Miami, he's hated for this first couple years. And I think the public love kind of peaked while he was in Cleveland, right? They win the title. The Warriors become so good, there's almost not any pressure on him. And, you know, I think it's like what everything people had expected. He is a champion. He has nothing to prove. And, you know, everyone just likes him. People are just enjoying watching him, you know, his playoff heroics. Then he gets to LA, and now he's had, I think, you know, he even mentions in the story, a really good quote in the story, where he said, even if you work at Starbucks, there's going to be four or five people who love you and four or five people who hate the way you make the chai tea latte. He says, you know, there's always going to be some people who love you, some people who hate you in the story. Because I do think he's had a little bit more of like a polarized relationship with the public again since getting to LA. You know, his basketball success has waxed and waned. He's had some weird kind of, you know, flashpoint political moments, whether it was with the China situation, the vaccine, things that he, I think, you know, had better success with at different points in his career. Did you get a sense from him? I mean, obviously this was not a focus of the piece. It only came up a little bit, but I'm curious if you got a sense from him, like, where does he... Did you get a sense where he feels like his public perception is now? Do you think he can notice that maybe it's kind of back to being mixed again? Because I think there was definitely a point in Cleveland where it felt like he actually had nothing to prove anymore. And now it kind of feels like, once again, there's like a contingent of people who are maybe a little bit tired of him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'd be curious your take on this, because I recall back when Durant was in OKC.
Mm-hmm.
And he was cast by the wider public perception.
The foil, yeah.
The media, like, Durant was the good guy.
Yeah.
Durant was the, you know, oh, he's doing this, you know, playing for this small market team, and he's re-upping. I think he got an extension right when LeBron was doing the decision.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pitted against each other, and which was unfair to both of them, obviously. And then he comes full circle to now, right? And I think what happens with these players, and anyone probably at that level of celebrity, is it's the first time they really get burned unfairly. Sometimes I think LeBron sort of admits now the decision, you know, that's a very fair criticism. But then the first time they get burned unfairly, I think they become much more cautious and wary. Mm-hmm. And then there's another evolution that occurs that we – can we swear on this podcast?
You can bleep it out.
Oh, I won't. But there's a phase that comes in often like the mid-30s where they get to like the F it phase.
Yeah, the Danny Glover, you know, just
– yeah. Yeah, it's like – yeah, Garnett. I mean, Garnett was always sort of there. Yeah. But, you know, Garnett, Kobe, they get there. That's like – for me, it's the most interesting phase. And I think that's where LeBron is a little bit. Where he's like, look, if I want to go to L.A. and I want to enjoy my life a little bit more, not focus entirely on basketball, there's going to be people that hate it, and that's okay, right? He stopped caring that much about all of the perception. And Durant, like, who knows where Durant is, you know, psychologically right now, but clearly he has sort of assumed that people are going to dislike him or mm-hmm. disagree with him. It's sort of hitting that point. I'll be curious where Durant is in maybe 2 or 3 years from now.
I do think that's an interesting point. I mean, I think we see it a little bit with LeBron and kind of that. I mean, Kobe, I think, was probably the most famous for it later in his career. There's like a clip of him on Jimmy Kimmel, like, reacting poorly to his teammate celebrating a regular season win. Like, he really did not care anymore. And I think you mentioned part of the myth building. I think he was able to weave that into kind of his own myth building. But yeah, it's very interesting with me to LeBron to kind of just chart the, I don't know how you describe it. I mean, Q score makes me sound like 80 years old, but just the relationship he has with fans and the public. You know, you mentioned like he's done so many off the court things. You know, it was towards the end of his Cleveland tenure, he opens the I Promise School in Akron, etc. And it feels like he's really riding high. And I wonder if kind of the, you know, what happened with China, what happened with some of these other things have accelerated kind of this F it phase for LeBron in his career. I want to ask you kind of a big question, because I think this was a great story. And I think this is probably the most candid LeBron has been in a story like this in a very long time. And there's some really good quotes in there, great quotes from Bronny and Savannah. Do you... Obviously, we're all, when we're writing a story like this, we're searching for a level of honesty, right? And we have to, you know, we want to believe that the people we're interviewing, everyone's participating in good faith. But LeBron is so big at this point in his career, right? You mentioned in the story, like, there may be, what, a dozen people, if that, that are more famous than him globally. He's truly one of the most famous people on the planet. You know, you're here sitting in this high school gym with him. Do you feel like it's still possible to get truth out of someone like that? Do you feel like it's still possible to get real honesty out of someone like that? Or is he just too famous now?
I don't know if it's like too famous as much as, I mean, I think that scenario in writing the story was a challenge in part because it was such a manufactured scenario. You know, if you spend amount of time around someone, and then you can have, there's these candid moments or real moments that start to come out, or conversations that are had. But it's like, you know, it's like 30 minutes and his kids are with him. And so it was clear to me, I thought it was important to put into the story what I thought LeBron was getting out of this. Like, why would it, first off, why would he do this interview? You know, why would he do it with Sports Illustrated? You know, all these questions that I, as a reader, would probably have in reading the story. You know, I don't have some like, you know, really deep relationship with LeBron. I think the lure of Sports Illustrated, the magazine itself, has dissipated significantly in the last 10 years, right? And so trying to figure that out, and you know, I did my best at guessing it, which I felt like this was a chance for him to sort of soft intro his kids to the world that they're gonna be joining pretty soon, especially Bronny, because Bronny's been able to do this curation, you know, through Instagram, through his dad's media company, Uninterrupted, which has been filming him for 3 years at Sierra Canyon. So he's accustomed to this, right? But there's still an edit side to it. So on the back end, there's an edit where LeBron can ultimately control it. But when he goes to college, he's not going to have that edit. And so here's an example. Like, I can sit down. It's only 30 minutes. You know, I'm going to sit here and be right here with you. Let's answer these questions essentially together. You know what I mean? So that was my take on it. You know, my assumption, I think LeBron also really wanted a cover shot of him with the boys. You know, that's sort of a cool full circle thing for him. But that's sort of how, I think it's how you have to frame it in these circumstances now is, well, why would, when an athlete, when someone as famous as LeBron, whose, you know, Instagram following dwarfs any any like distribution that our magazine and website would get, if he wants to say something, he certainly doesn't need to say it to us. So why is he here? I mean, I think with almost any media venture now, that's a really important question as a reader to ask and as a writer.
Did you do anything this time to jolt the interview? Or did you just, you're like, I don't have a lot of time, I got to jump straight into it?
Well, in this case, it didn't need it as much because Bryce and Bronny were there.
I see.
Because like, for them, this thing, I mean, I could tell Bronny was sort of going into, you know, sort of, I'm going to make a couple comments here, but he wasn't very, I was actually a little bit surprised at how unpracticed he was at this. You know, most people who've been in the media glare that long will get a certain patter, you know, the athlete patter, which they have when they're younger, you know, one game at a time, all that kind of stuff, right?
For
he didn't quite have that yet, and neither did Bryce. So that itself created an almost uncertainty to it. And I could see LeBron fluctuating in an interview between, like, the kids would almost mimic something he would say, and he would like that, and he'd expound upon it. But then other times, he could see them sort of flailing a bit in the interview, and he'd sort of jump in, or he'd laugh, or he'd try to spur them on. So that dynamic, to me, was as interesting as anything else. But also, because the kids were there, I couldn't ask the questions that I wanted to ask. I originally had asked for Bronny separate, LeBron separate, and then the group thing. Because part of what I really want to know is, like, you know, Bronny, I want to know, without his dad sitting there, what did you think when your dad said that? You know, how does that feel? What do these expectations feel like? And then also separately to LeBron, right? You know, did you have that conversation with Bronny? And how do you, you know, get that parenting conversation? So I had to, it was a challenge to fold it all into one. And he was great. I mean, LeBron's one of those guys, you know, Draymond Green's like this, you know this, obviously. Jimmy Butler, who you've written great stories on, where you can almost print every quote. Like, every quote's going to have something in it.
Before we move on, because I want to talk to you about a couple other stories you've written, some of my favorites. But I guess just overall, looking back on it now, what were some of those favorite moments? It really is. I mean, it's a remarkable story. Again, it is when you really, like, sit back and think about it, it really is crazy to think that, like, someone as famous as LeBron still wants to be on the cover of our little magazine here. When you look back now, what things stood out to you? Did you stick around for the photo shoot? Obviously, you watched him coach. What are just some of the fun things, the cool things that you remember from that weekend, things that maybe someone only from your vantage position gets to see?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I didn't really have space to put in the story, Adam Duerson was the editor on this, and he was great, but it was like, we can't run 10,000 words, Ballard. Like, we gotta, you know, we actually have to put this in a magazine.
For those of you that wondering, this is a common problem for Chris Ballard, by the way,
yes.
Who has for years been told they can't print a certain number of words in the magazine, but insists on turning his stories in that long anyway.
Yeah, not necessarily always beloved by editors for that. But it was seeing Akron and LeBron, because if he'd been in LA, there would have been, you know, the second this got out, everyone with their phones and, you know, like, crowds and autograph seekers, all that kind of stuff. Because he's back there so much, because he still has a home there, it is probably as close to normal as LeBron will be in a public setting. And it was really cool to see these ties coming back around, where I would talk to the security guards there, and they had been there when LeBron was in high school, and now they're retired Akron PD who were brought in for this tournament. They've known the guy since he was a teenager, you know, so they're hugging him, and, you know, I think Lloyd Floyd, maybe, I'm getting it wrong. One of the security guys I spoke to, but he's like, I just hugged a billionaire. Like, you know, they've seen this kid grow up. And to see LeBron being so woven into the community, and then Gloria would show up and she would hug everybody, and Savannah, and seeing this sort of genuine connection that he's maintained. And I know that's something that he's big on. That's sort of his cause. You know, if each celebrity picks a cause, his cause is like, I'm going to give back to my hometown. But you can really see it there. And there's not any of that. So you could sort of get a sense of watching that play out, and I was sitting next to the bench while he was coaching, watching people's reactions to him. And then also at a couple times I'd hear kids behind me, and they weren't yelling at LeBron, they were yelling at Bronny. And was recognizing that for, like, you know, the generation coming up now, to some of them, like, Bronny's just as big a star as his dad. Which was shocking to me, but of course I'm not living on TikTok, so it's not my world.
It's funny. I can't remember if it was a Lee story or not, and I feel bad for not remembering now. I kind of assume it almost has to be, but someone wrote once that there's like a diner or something in LeBron or in Akron that LeBron and his family go to, and it's like no one bothers them. Like, they just go. Like, they wouldn't even print the name in the story because, like, they didn't want people from outside of Akron going there to find him. I do think it's fascinating that he has this place that he can go to, and it's, like, you know, this relatively small city, and he can just be somewhat normal. I find that really interesting.
Yeah, and the flip side of that was weird. If, you know, I sat next to the bench, right? And I'd turn around, you know, LeBron would face the players in the huddle when he's coaching these games. And so he'd be standing up facing the players, you know, who are sitting on the bench. But if you turned and looked at what LeBron was seeing, that's what was, like, the entire, like, the bleachers are all staring at him. And I put this in the story, but it really was unnerving to turn around and look at. It's like, oh, wow, they're all trying to film him, right, or wave at him. Like, he's trying to be part of this huddle. And to recognize that that's how he goes through life, is at all times people are staring at you. That's got to be, I mean, I don't. What does that do to you? Like, how do you try to stay normal when everywhere you go, whatever you do, you turn around and someone's staring at you? Like, yep, this guy's staring at me too.
You know, that to me is the real story about LeBron, and not sure that it, like, it's one that you can really pitch him in the midst of his basketball career. But I think that that's the most. The guy's been so famous for so long, and he's not a perfect person, but the fact that he's relatively normal, like, hasn't had some kind of, think of like the great movie, like Tom Cruise, like, was famous for so long and then he finally kind of snapped, and now it's like he has the most manicured, curated public persona you could possibly have, like, literally can only make a certain type of movie, like child stars. I mean, there's numerous examples. What fame does to people clearly is, like, generally not healthy. And he's managed to avoid most of the pitfalls. And I find that I honestly just don't know how. I remember I was stringing for the Miami Herald. Like, I was in college and they asked me to cover a Heat Bulls game. And this was the last year of the Big Three. And you could tell that entire year, like, I got to cover a few of their games. Like, you could tell the team was, like, just tired of all the attention. Like, it was the fourth year of every single locker room was incredibly crowded, too much attention. And I think you could tell they were just kind of mentally over it. Like, it was never ending. And it was a Heat Bulls game. Dwayne Wade didn't play. And, you know, the Bulls always played the Heat tough. It was such a physical game. You know, that year especially, Wade was in and out of the lineup. There was so much physical burden on LeBron with the Heat that year, which is obviously he didn't sign with the team for that, right? He wanted to avoid that. So he's got this big physical burden on him. It's a physical game. They lose. In the locker room after the game, there's, of course, like, just a gigantic media crush around LeBron. He's answering all these questions about, you know, why they can't beat the Bulls, you know, why they lost, etc. And I believe it was a Chinese media member. I asked him a question, like, and, you know, you've been in this position, like, other people have been in scrums. There's, like, a certain, you know, unspoken etiquette that people follow. You know, like, people are a little bit more understanding in some ways after a loss. I mean, you're still asking the questions you want to ask, but, you know, you kind of know this is not the moment that I'm going to ask, like, a relationship building question unless I'm a beat reporter who is getting sure. A minute walking out the door. You know, it's especially if you're, you know, kind of parachuting in. So a Chinese reporter asked LeBron, LeBron, are you going to watch this game that's happening in China tomorrow, you know, featuring these teams, whatever? It was like a big game. And it's just one of those questions. It's like, it's so out of left field, right? And it, like, no, first of all, no other player would get asked that, right? No other player after a regular season game in the winter is getting asked a question like that. They're not being asked to think about something like that. And, you know, LeBron gives a very, he's like, oh, you know, I would love to watch that game. I think, unfortunately, we're traveling or playing tomorrow. You know, hopefully I can catch it some other time. Gives, like, a very patient answer. But just, like, the patience required to be him. And I'm sure, you know, it's gotten that way for maybe Steph Curry to an extent, maybe Kevin Durant to an extent. But I don't think anyone has it quite like him. And I think that the patience required for him is, I honestly don't know how he does that.
Well, and the willingness, I think that's what, one of the things that most impresses me about LeBron, he's been in the league almost 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. And so he's still willing to carry the banner for the NBA. Yeah, it's something that, man, it's got to be exhausting, but there's a certain number of players and coaches in the league who will always answer those questions professionally, thinking broader than whatever the small, the myopic mm-hmm. thing. Oh yeah, this is good. This is going, someone in China is going to see this answer. I should produce, you know, and Steph's another one. Like, Steph will always do that. And I mean, it's got to be remarkably hard to do that year after year after year. And for him to still carry the banner for the league like that, and to value the traditions of the league and to value the mythology of the league, I think it's one of the things that LeBron perhaps is. I mean, there's a lot of reasons that you can criticize LeBron, right? But mm-hmm. I think one of the things that he perhaps is not appreciated for quite so much is that like he carries a reverence for it. So, like he will do that. The draft was hilarious this year, the All-Star yeah. game draft, right? Like he'll do these things and he will take them seriously and he will make them interesting. Steph the same way. You sort of get the sense that Giannis is going to evolve into that a little bit. Mm-hmm. And those players are so important for the league.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know. I feel like this has been such a LeBron forward podcast. I think we both just, it's just a fascination. I'm really just fascinated by, there are very few people that exist like this in our society. And one of them happens to be a basketball player. And I find it very fascinating. We've been talking about this for a while. I wanted to talk about a couple other stories you've written because, you know, I think I read them before we had ever even met. And there's stories that have truly stuck with me for a long time.
Before we leave LeBron, please. Though, I did look it up. Lloyd Ford is his
Lloyd
name.
Lloyd Ford, okay.
Was the retired Akron PD.
Okay, good. I'm glad that you brought this up because that is going to kind of work into a part of what I want to ask you next. I will say Lloyd Floyd was an incredible name, but shout out to yeah. Lloyd Ford. Yeah. So I don't even know what year was it now, but you wrote a story. I think you write my favorite Where Are They Now stories. I mean, it helps that a lot of them are NBA focused, but you wrote, it had to be a Where Are They Now piece on Robert Swift, right?
No, actually, I've only done one Where Are They Now, and it was
and that was the Amici one?
John Amici one, yeah.
So
yeah.
these were spiritual Where Are They Nows, I guess is what I'll call them. Because Sam Hinkie was another one that you wrote after his Sixers tenure that I guess was not official. But Robert Swift, for those who don't remember, I mean, this is an NBA podcast, I'm sure you guys remember him, but he was just one of kind of like the all-time draft bus, unfortunately, really tall guy drafted by the Sonics. I think he came straight out of high school. Just always looked awkward and uncomfortable. Was this pale, redheaded guy? Just never looked in place on an NBA court. And his story, I mean, it's very sad. I mean, he was having a lot of financial troubles. I really encourage people to read the story. I guess the best way to do it is just Google Chris Ballard, Robert Swift. But, you know, it's a story about what happens to someone who, you know, flames out of the draft like that. And, you know, there's the one point in the story, I remember you mentioned, like, you bought him food, right?
Yeah.
That stuck with me for a long time because I think, again, to peel back the curtain a little bit here, you mentioned a guy like Lloyd Ford, right? When I went to Philadelphia and I wrote a Dion Waiters story, I was so excited. It was like the first big profile I'd ever really written, and SI was sending me to travel, and it was great.
You killed it.
Oh, thank you. Well, you talk about guys who you could print anything they say. Dion Waiters is probably at the top of that list for me. And, you know, obviously it's great. The access was phenomenal. You know, I got to spend so much time with Dion, but it's such an interesting thing through the course of these stories that we write. Like, I remember I met Dion Waiters' AAU coach, and I was interviewing him. We were supposed to meet Dion at a cheesesteak place. He showed up a little later than everyone else. So I'm just eating lunch with his old AAU coach. You know, he is telling me about all these different places in Philadelphia. That night, I had to, like, catch a train back to New York. And he was like, I'll drive you to the train station. I'm like, really? It's no problem. Like, work will cover my taxi. He's like, no. Like, why would we do that? Like, I'll give you a ride. And he's, you know, as we were walking around Philadelphia that day, his name's Aaron Abbott. You know, he's pointing out, he's like, this is the park where Monet Davis played baseball before she, you know, got to the Little League World Series. You make such interesting connections through the course of these stories sometimes. And you mentioned it can be, I'm sure that moment on some level at first blush was like a little bit conflicting for you because we're always taught, right? We're supposed to keep ourselves out of this as much as possible. Sometimes at the expense of our humanity almost, which I think people are moving away from, and I think that's good. I think you do a good job. You mentioned in your LeBron story, like you told me, you know, part of the reason you wanted to write this, your father, that's something you can connect with people about. I'm just curious because I feel like it's something I struggle with, and that's just maybe who I am as a person, but how difficult do you find it to keep yourself removed from a story when you're reporting it?
It obviously depends on the story, right? Mm-hmm. And the depth that you're going into. I think it's like whenever you can get to a human level in a story, that's going to be more valuable for the reader. And I think it's more fair to the person you're writing about. One of the mm-hmm. stories that always stuck with me, and I might get this a little bit wrong, but I'm trying to remember it, is when Harrison Barnes was with the Warriors, and I'm pretty sure he suggested this, him and Marcus Thompson went around Oakland because Harrison wanted to see Marcus's old neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And Marcus wrote it. I mean, Marcus is great. He wrote a great story about it. But it was that same kind of thing. Like, wait a second. You're always asking me questions. People were always like, they want to know about my life. I'm curious about your life. Mm-hmm. And that becomes then suddenly, if I'm reading something that Marcus has written about Harrison, I know there's like a human connection there because, you know, regardless of how you cover this, unless you're doing just the analysis or data side of it, you know, it can be easy, especially early in my journalism career. And I think when you're a younger reporter, it can be easy to forget that these are like human beings because they're these avatars on screen and, you know, we talk about them and some of them are so good at this sort of protective armor that you need. Because if your job is one where you get yelled at all the time and criticized for everything, you need to create that protective armor. So I found that, you know, whenever it's possible to connect on a human level, the story is going to be better. Right. And so, you know, Robert Swift was one of those where I was initially interested in his story, like a lot of people, because I was just curious, you know, how did this happen? How does someone go from being a lottery pick and, you know, bringing in millions of dollars to ending up in jail because he was found in a meth dealer's house and there was an FBI raid, right? So that arc is bonkers. But if you just like right after that happened, when he was arrested and there were all the headlines, it was very much focused on the look at this crazy thing that happened and this guy. And then you get like that list of Bleacher Report stories of, you know, biggest flameouts in NBA history. And like Robert Swift, you're like right pop, like right at the top. And that itself must be, you know, you think about that, like you're 29 and you're like your public life perception is done. You're sort of stopped. You're frozen there as this guy. And I always find those stories to be the most interesting. Well, what happens after that? And that's, you know, where are they now? It's the same kind of concept. I often find that athletes, if they're in the middle of their career, are the least interesting. It's often towards the end or if something, you know, you get a full arc of life that happens during a playing career, and then another arc that happens afterwards. So that was interest in Swift, was to figure out, you know, not only why did this happen, but where, you know, when that happens, or when you do it to yourself, which is sort of the turn of the story, you know, what do you do next?
The Swift one is, I mean, especially is, you mentioned there's an FBI raid. I mean, that's kind of the lead to the story, is him, I think, waking up in the middle of this raid. And it's truly one of my favorite Sports Illustrated stories of all time. I mean that genuinely, Chris. I remember it vividly to this day. Can you tell me, I know people have maybe not read it in years, I guess just to give them kind of an overview, Swift was drafted in 2004. He was out of the league within 3 or 4 years. I mean, he's with the Sonics. He never really made a mark in the league. You know, he eventually becomes drug addict, arrested. How do you begin to like approach a story like that? Did you go in with kind of a, do you have a preconceived notion? Are you trying to get rid of your preconceived notions? Like, how do you begin to approach something like that? That I think that when any of us do something like that, there's a responsibility you have, right? Like you don't want to coddle someone, but also maybe you do a little bit, you know what I mean? Like maybe empathy and sympathy is good. How did you approach something like that?
Yeah, those kind of stories, there's a lot of those kind of stories you look into that you don't write. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because it's, you know, on a human level first, if Robert's in a place, in that case, if you find him and he's in a place where things are just really dark, on one hand, for him as a human being, this is not good to have like a national exposure, right? Mm-hmm. And you worry, especially with someone who's an addict, what they, you know, the repercussions of that. And then secondarily, as a story, it's not a good story either. Mm-hmm. Cause it's almost like it's almost like a gratuitous kind of thing. You want to feel like there's some hope. It needs to be real. Yeah. And so with Robert, I originally reached out, to Bob Hill, who is a longtime Spurs coach, a longtime NBA coach who had overlapped with Robert during his playing career. And then he turned me on to his son, Casey Hill, who had been with Robert. He played in Japan briefly after his NBA career. He had a bit of a comeback there. And if you look back, I mean, you know, Robert did a lot that put himself in trouble. Mm-hmm. But he also came into a team, the Sonics. They had Ray Allen in the prime of his career. He had no interest in playing, understandably, with a project. Nate McMillan had no interest in tutoring a prospect. Mm-hmm. He was a guy who loved his vets. So he's sort of adrift. The next youngest player on the team, Luke Ridenour, is 4 years older than him. So Swift comes in. He's got a bunch of money. He's got an unstable family situation. His parents are basically like on an allowance from him. And so like there's a lot that could have gone wrong and that did go wrong. And also he has like back-to-back ACL mm-hmm. and then a meniscus where he's out a year and a year. So then his body's toast. And so even though he'd looked good at one point, so all the things are rolling in the wrong direction. Then he has shots that, you know, he plays well in Japan. It was like always something. He was playing really well in Japan, like 22 and 20 in a game. And then there was the earthquake. And the basketball season's canceled. And, you know, there'd be these sort of intercessions within his life. And then he hits a dark place and sort of, you know, spirals darker. But, you know, in contact, I wanted to see, is there a chance that he's, because I knew he had left prison, and I knew he hadn't gone back. His stay in prison was pretty brief. And so it was finding, okay, he's trying to come back. Okay, that was enough for me to look into it. Was, okay, he's trying to come back, which means he's playing basketball again. And for him, because his narrative was frozen there at his lowest moment, almost anything after that, for him, I assumed might be a better story. And so then it became about, you know, gaining trust. And I drove up to Roseville and had lunch off the record first and mm-hmm. sort of tried to be very, very explicit about and transparent about the level of detail that I put in my stories. You know, it's like 6, 7, as you said, 10,000 words sometimes that come down to 6 or 7. But I felt like for, you know, you want someone to know, okay, we got to, like, if this is going to work, we got to get into the dark stuff to get back to the light stuff, you know, not light, but in terms mm-hmm. of the, to you trying to get back there.
Right. Yeah. It's, I really encourage everyone to read that story. It's, the reporting is incredible. It's, I just Googled it right now. Cause now that I think about it, I'm like, oh man, what happened? You know, he played basketball in Spain for 3 years, 2018 to 2021. That makes me feel nice.
Yeah, yeah, actually, I did a little web follow-up on him, and he was loving it. He's like, I'm like 2 blocks from the beach, and I like my team. And, you know, he was essentially getting, you know, enough, like a free place to live and food and a little bit of money, and he kept playing. And so, you know, I haven't spoken to him in a couple years, but at least the last time I had, it seemed like he was still sort of on the right track.
That's awesome. Okay, I know we're kind of pushing up against our time limit here, but I just want to ask about one more story that you wrote. That was Sam Hinkie. You got him post his resignation from the Sixers. I think I don't know if it was the lead of the story, but I remember you mentioned, like, you know, he shaved his head. He's, you know, it's the gritty reboot of Sam Hinkie. I just want to know, like, is he a crazy person? What's his vibe? Like, does he give off the vibe of, like, a shady tech billionaire? Like, what's his deal?
Complete opposite.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, no, he is one of the most relatable people in person. It was always this big contrast between what people expected of Sam Hinkie and then if you met Sam Hinkie. Right? He's from Oklahoma. He's got like a little bit of twang to his voice. He's funny. He's relatable. He's pithy. That's why I kept trying to convince him to do this story and to talk for a story. And I tried to explain him, look, like people think you're very different than you are. And anyone who was working in the NBA at the time, in the media knew it because he was a phenomenal source. He just wouldn't be on the record. You know, back when he was with the Rockets, as I met him when he was with the Rockets and I did a story on Yao Ming, and Sam was this great background source. And did a story on Daryl Morey. Chris Stone, of course, titled it Money Ballsy. classic Chris Stone headline. But once again, like Hinkie, he was so good because he saw a big picture, but he could explain things in detail. And then, you know, when he got to the Sixers, he just, you know, he felt like if he was part of the, if he was front and center, that wasn't what was good for the team, and that any information that he gave out could ruin their competitive advantage. So ergo, you got like
competitive advantage.
Yeah, he looked like a
they
robot
were trying to lose games.
Oh, as far as trades, draft picks, everything.
Yeah, sure.
I mean,
sure.
So, but I think that's what he ended up regretting a little bit was not showing a little more humanity, not just publicly, but even with agents, right? You know, agents did not like Sam when he was there. But Sam's. I mean, he's a great guy. If you read the story, that probably comes through. And I think that was, if he had to do it over again, he probably would show a little bit more of his personality. Mm.
Do you think he looks back on the process? I mean, I'm really asking you to go into his mind here, so this is a little unfair. But when you think back to when you write that story, like, did you get the sense that he looked back on that time, like, with a sense of humor, with a sense of regret? Like, because that was it. I mean, I think part of it is there's, you know, I don't want to put on my conspiracy hat here, but I think it's obvious the NBA was not a big fan of what he was doing. It's a little strange. I'm thinking part of it is him. I'm sure part of it is the league that he's not really re-entered the NBA. What sense did you get on how he kind of viewed his Sixers tenure?
I mean, Sam is such a longest view in the room kind of guy, hyper rational, you know. But I think, you know, if you look at the effect that his tenure had, it effectively, you got a bunch of copycats. They got to change the lottery system. And then, you know, some would see Embiid and the Sixers rising to relative prominence as vindication, right? It all depends on perception. But I happened to be, when I did that story, I think it was the night before Embiid had debuted and gone, you know, 20-10 or whatever it was. And you know, it was sort of the height of the cult of Hinkie online. And so, he was trending on Twitter that morning, even though he wasn't with the Sixers anymore. So I think, you know, the more time passes, the more people probably look back and see what he did and recognize that it was, you know, in the same way that like Don Nelson was revolutionary as a coach, but it didn't always mean that Don Nelson won, if that makes sense. You know, I think Sam Hinkie affected change in the NBA and people learned a lot from what he did. But he didn't get the rewards of it. So it's that weird, you know, like someone else takes Don Nelson's point forward concept and wins a title, you know, but Don sort of was the progenitor of it.
Listen, I think Don Nelson did win, okay? That man is just, what is he, in Hawaii smoking a ton of weed now?
Yes, he is.
Listen, good for Don Nelson.
That's another story I did.
Yes. And I believe I texted you after, did you smoke with Don Nelson or not? And then you wouldn't tell me the answer. And I'm not going to put you on the spot right now, but just know that I'm still upset about that. All I'm saying is, listen, Don Nelson, do you want to run that back? You want to do another SI story? I'll come out to Hawaii. You know, we'll sample the local product. We'll see what's up.
Don, you got to be ready. Don is very good at shuffleboard, and he's got his own shuffleboard table. He'll want to play you for money.
For money? Oh boy!
I'm not kidding. Yeah,
that's awesome. That's very cool.
Don's got some good stories.
I'm sure he does. Wow, talk about a fascinating life and career. Chris, I think that'll do it for this episode, though. Thank you so much. I think I told you we were only going to talk for 45 minutes, and here we are, nearly an hour later. So thank you so much for your time. Is there anything you're working on that you want to let us know about? What's going on in your life? This is an opportunity for you. You know, you talk about LeBron's Instagram following. I don't know that it compares to the power of the Open Floor Globe. So if there's anything that you're working on that you'd like to let the people know about, this is a chance for you to do so.
Well, thank you. I'm doing another in that same sort of vein of someone who potential. They were in one spot, and now 10 years later, where are they? One of those. We'll see if it pans out, but definitely looking forward to seeing what happens with the power struggle in the NBA. I think that's what I'm most interested in, is the way that Durant – I'm not answering your question at all, but I do think it's I want to see how it plays out this season. You know, Durant now coming back to the Nets. I'm wondering if this will shift some of the player empowerment era or not.
Are you still teaching?
Not this semester, no.
Okay, because I was wondering why I had not gotten the invite to speak to your students recently. I wasn't sure if maybe you'd lost my phone number and my email address somehow. It's been a little while. I think that the first time I did it, it was a huge success. So I was just a little surprised that that call hadn't come in yet.
Yeah, I can tell your listeners that you certainly were the most memorable guest.
There we go.
For the students.
I think I got there a few minutes before you, and I was like, "Is he a tough grader?" And everyone was like, "Yes." And I was like, "Well, that sucks. I don't know what that's about." Listen, man, they're paying you. You know what I mean? What's going on here? Just give them all A's.
That is essentially the thing you learn about journalism school pretty quickly. grades have never been more meaningless than in journalism school.
All right. Well, that will do it for this episode of Open Floor. Once again, Chris, thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for all our listeners. If you would like to email us, please keep the emails coming. Openfloormail@gmail.com. Until the next episode, please continue to enjoy the NBA offseason.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.